Good morning. My guest today along Highway 101 was probably the single most effective member of Bill Clinton's first cabinet from 1993 to 1997. He didn't stay for a second ride on the merry-go-round. Robert Reich was born in 1946 with Fairbanks disease. This has restricted his growth to just under 5 feet, but it has had no effect whatever on his determination, his resilience, his articulacy or his intelligence. He's worked for the most famous failed Supreme Court nominee, Robert Bork, and has been a classmate of another who almost failed, Clarence Thomas. In that same class in Yale Law School were two young friends who have been in and out of his life ever since, Bill Clinton and the then Hillary Rodham. He's written more than a dozen books, none more engaging, funny and at times poignant than Locked in the Cabinet, his memoir of 4 years as the 22nd US Secretary of Labour. It's a book about the achievement of power and the limitations of that power. Today, he hurls from the ditch as an academic, as a liberal, political and economic commentator on public TV and national radio. Robert Reich, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Miles. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, your father, he was a hardworking man and you didn't see an awful lot of him, did you?
I didn't. He was worried about making enough for our family to live on. He had a clothing store, sold $1.98 cotton dresses and blouses to women who worked in the local factory and the wives of factory workers. And, you know, in retrospect, it was a very poor upbringing. Monetarily, we just skirted by, but I was never aware of being deprived. I don't think children, unless they don't have enough food on the table, are aware that their family is relatively poor.
And he would have been politically quite conservative. Your mother, on the other hand, was much more radical. I think her side of the family, going back seed, breed and generation, perhaps, were considerably more radical.
Yes, that's right. My father came from, well, actually, his father before him, they were all Republicans. And I remember my father saying to me when I was a little tiny child that I and my children and their children will be paying for the debts that Franklin D. Roosevelt created. Now, again, my father was very working class and Jewish. Most working class Jewish people were Franklin D. Roosevelt Democrats. I don't know why he was a Republican. He's no longer. He's still alive at the age of 93, still plays golf and dances and his, you know, but he's become a radical lefty. He's way to the left of me now. I don't know where that happened. My mother was, yes, her family had been much more activist in Democratic circles, and I guess I got some of my political inheritance from her.
You, I think, managed to get yourself expelled from nursery school. Were you a troublemaker even then?
I was expelled for excessive sarcasm. Now, I was only 3 years old. I don't think I knew what sarcasm was, but the nursery school teacher, I was a very finicky eater. And the nursery school teacher asked me, did I like my lunch? And I had left the entire lunch there. And I said it was absolutely delicious. And apparently she thought that I was a revolutionary and promptly expelled me. My mother was devastated.
Your family also moved around quite a lot when you were a kid. Did you find that difficult to deal with, moving?
No, I didn't. We spent most of my young life in the Hudson Valley of what anybody in New York City would consider to be northern New York State, very rural, some factories, and it was gradually becoming more urbanized. But most of my friends were either the children of factory workers or farmers, and a wonderful place to grow up.
Mm. And you were, I think you were the victim of bullying at school, weren't you?
Well, I was because of my height. The big boys who... I guess when I was in kindergarten, I was 5 years old, 6 years old, first grade. And they were probably all of third or fourth grade, you know, 8 or 9 years old. But they would, yes, they'd shove me around and beat me up sometimes. So I very early on developed a methodology, a kind of a means of keeping the bullies at bay, and that was to get some big fellow to be my protector, to kind of be a friend and. But to be around me, to make sure the bullies didn't bully me. And I did that quite successfully.
One of those friends, one of those guys, was a guy called Mickey Schwerner. Tell me a little bit about what happened to him later.
Well, Mickey did protect me from the bullies when I was a little fellow. He was an older, about 3 years older than I. And then in the summer of 1964, Mickey, along with two others, were civil rights workers. They had gone down to Mississippi to register voters, black voters, African Americans, for what was the civil rights struggle. And the three of them, Mickey included, were brutally murdered by white extremists who were dead set against civil rights. And that, of course, had a very profound impact on me. By then, I was heading off to college. But you see, the fact that Mickey had kept the bullies at bay when I was a little boy, and then the bullies, a different set of bullies, a real vicious set of bullies, had finally done him in. I didn't know it at the time, but it became pretty evident to me that it changed my sense of what I needed to do. I needed to be an activist. I needed to dedicate myself to social justice, to overcoming injustices. My path, I think, was affected very dramatically by that.
You avoided the draft, the Vietnam draft, because you were under the required height. But you had to go through the whole process, the induction process. Tell me about that induction.
Yes, well, I was out here in Berkeley. I was actually that summer. I had graduated from college. I was working as a research assistant for an architect who was doing some very innovative work in low-income, poor communities, neighborhood health centers and so on. And I got my draft induction notice. I had been, by that time, active in the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. Didn't expect that I would be inducted because I was under 5 feet, still am, will always be. I reported for induction, a little bit apprehensive, but I thought, well, they must, once they actually measure me, they'll know. But the examining sergeant looked at me coming toward him. I'll never forget this. Down the corridor in the Oakland Induction Center. And by the way, Oakland, that Oakland Induction Center had become the scene of a lot of riots, a lot of controversy. But the day I reported, everything was calm. And he looked at me and he smiled and his eyes grew big and his pupils dilated. And he said, "Aha, look what we have here, a tunnel rat." And
the tunnel rats were within the American Army.
Yes, they were. They were people who would take little landmines and they would throw them at the VC, at the Viet Cong, under the rice paddies. They would they'd flush the Viet Cong out, and they would not last very long. And my life just went right before my eyes. I thought, oh heavens, I'm going to be gone pretty soon. But he measured me. And I remember that measuring rod kind of hitting the top of my head. I didn't know what it showed, but he put his big hand on my shoulder and he said, "I'm sorry, son." I didn't know at that time whether he was sorry I was going to Vietnam or sorry that I wasn't going to Vietnam, and I wasn't about to ask him. I just said, "Well, that's okay." And I looked downcast. He said, "You're too short." And I wanted to shout for joy, but then I thought, "I better not." And I said, "Oh, well, I'm very sorry about that." But I didn't want to overdo being sorry because I thought he might make an exception. And so I was a little bit of quandary. But the good news for me and obviously the sad news for 50,000 others is that the war continued to rage on for years thereafter. A terrible tragedy, terrible tragedy.
How did you get to know the Clintons?
Well, I was selected to be a Rhodes Scholar when I was in college, just as I was graduating from college. And we all Rhodes Scholars, we all... In those days, the tradition was to take a boat together across the Atlantic so we get to know one another before we commenced our studies at Oxford. It was a very stormy passage. I went down to my cabin, thought I'd never come up again, and there was a knock on my door. I opened it, and this tall, gangly Southerner, who I had met very, very briefly on the dock before we embarked in New York, said, I hear you weren't feeling too well. And he had chicken soup in one hand and crackers in another. And I was touched. I was also sick. I was about to vomit on him. Vomiting on a future president would not make a very good impression, but I didn't know he was going to be a future president. It was Bill Clinton. He said, what he did not say, though, he said he did not say, "I feel your pain." That came later. But he was a very charming man. He told a lot of stories, very funny. He very political, loved politics, wanted to go back to Arkansas and run for governor. Even then, he was 22 at the time. Didn't talk about president. But the irony, you see, was that I had already, even then, known Hillary Rodham, even before I met Bill Clinton, way before he met Hillary, because she had been president of her class at Wellesley College, where she had gone as an undergraduate. I had been president of my class at Dartmouth College, where I had gone as an undergraduate, and we had a presidential summit, a disguised date.
Ah, a disguise, because I was going to ask you, did you date Hillary Clinton and therefore miss the opportunity to totally change the course of modern American history by not marrying her?
Well, I don't. She wouldn't have had me, and I don't think I would have had her. But we called it a presidential meeting, but it was sort of a date. We went out to see a movie, I remember. It was Blow Up, Antonioni's Blow Up. And all I remember about the movie was sitting there and being a little bit mesmerized by it, and she was sitting next to me, and she wanted a lot of – I remember she wanted a lot of butter on her popcorn. I don't know if there's any significance there about what kind of a president she would make. But these kinds of facts come out in a presidential election season, you know.
And when Bill Clinton began his run for president, what kind of chance did you give him?
Well, nobody knew who he was. People would ask me – in fact, I remember on a national news program, I was interviewed and somebody asked me who I thought was going to be the next president. This is 1991. Remember, he was elected in November of 1992. And I said, Bill Clinton. And this national correspondent, who was very otherwise quite worldly, he said, no, who's Bill Clinton? And I said, well, he's governor of Arkansas. And there was not very much credibility given. The only thing people remembered him for was that he had given a kind of introductory address to Michael Dukakis when Michael Dukakis had been nominated for president in 1988 and had Bill Clinton didn't know when to stop. In fact, the only applause line was when he said, in conclusion, and everybody said, finally, you know, he had a reputation for just to the extent anybody remembered him of talking too much. But I did think he had a good chance to become president because he was very articulate. He understood the issues better than anyone else. He had a very charismatic personality. And even though nobody knew of him, I was aware that it's very difficult for senators, for U.S. senators to become president. John F. Kennedy is the only one in the second half of the 20th century who did. You have to be a governor more often than not. You have to run a state government. That's how you actually get to be president. People forget that every time an election comes around in the United States. Bill Clinton had been governor of Arkansas. He had done a very, very credible job. He had the experience. I wasn't surprised he won.
How much chance, though, did you give him after the publicity began about his history of extramarital affairs?
People say to me, you know, you knew him from the time he was 22. Didn't you know about this history? And I didn't. It came as a complete surprise to me. But I knew that he was very adept at getting out of corners. You know, when his back metaphorically is pushed to the wall, he knows how to say just exactly what he needs to say and do what he needs to do, and he can kind of get back to wherever he wants to be. So I wasn't particularly worried about that.
And how much influence did you have on the Clinton presidential campaign?
Well, you know, presidential campaign, everybody who advises a president in a campaign thinks that they have...
They won the election first.
Yes, they think that they single-handedly did it. I flatter myself into thinking that I helped guide the substance of the campaign in terms of the major theme of the campaign in 1992, which was investing in people, education, job training, health care. The notion was you couldn't possibly have a productive workforce if you didn't invest directly in them, which was quite contrary to the Reagan view, which was you award the rich, give them tax breaks and extra money, and they'll invest in everybody else, kind of trickle-down theory. My theory was sort of bubble-up or bottom-up theory, and I think Bill Clinton, I flatter myself again, I don't know that he came to this because I kept telling him. He did talk the right talk in 1992 and 1993.
So you were at least partly responsible for the it's the economy stupid philosophy that prevailed during that campaign in 1992.
Yes, I think I was. And then as soon as he was elected, the week after he was elected in November of 1992, he called me. I was then teaching at Harvard, and he asked me to run his economic transition team. I had no idea what an economic transition team was, but I was excited that he was – you know, I said, I have a family here. I can't do very much for you, but I'd be happy to come down to Little Rock, Arkansas, and Washington. And what he wanted me to do was pull together all the brightest economic minds who shared his values – and come up with a plan to get the economy going again and to invest in people.
So that you could hit the ground running.
Absolutely.
When he actually took office.
But it was a very heady time. People today, many of them either don't remember because they were too young to remember, or they just forget how excited America was. Here was a young, vigorous new president with a lot of new ideas. We had come through 12 years of Republicans, Reagan and Bush, the first Bush. And now we were set to get on with the agenda, the progressive agenda that had been put on hold for so many years.
And did you have confidence at the time that Bill Clinton would actually bring about the changes that you and he sought?
Let's put it this way, Miles. I'm realistic enough, was then, am now, to know how difficult it is in our system of government, divided government, divided power, checks and balances, for any single person, even if they're elected president, to do everything they want to do. But remember, the Democrats did control the House and the Senate when Bill Clinton came to power. So it's one of those rare moments when all of the stars are aligned, and I did expect we could get more done than, unfortunately, we did.
And did you go to Washington and work for Bill Clinton? Because I know you were reluctant because you had family, you had your own commitments. Did you go because you felt that you had to put your money where your mouth was, basically?
Yes, I did. I had now, again, my personal problem was that we had very young children at the time who were two boys who were steaming toward adolescence. And it's a particularly vulnerable time and fragile time in the history of young boys or girls, where they need their parents around. And I felt very badly taking those years and dedicating them to being in Bill Clinton's cabinet and Secretary of Labor. But I did also feel that these opportunities almost never come along. I mean, how many people? There are 13, 14 people in a president's cabinet. How many presidents are going to ask you to be in their cabinet and guide the ship of state? Well, it doesn't come along. So I persuaded my family to come with me.
You also had another personal issue, and that was you had problems. You had to have two artificial hips in 1992. Would you have been able to function? Would you have been able to do the job as Secretary of Labor without those artificial hips?
It would have been harder. By the time I had the hip replacements, I couldn't walk. I mean, I was just I absolutely could not walk more than a couple of feet. And so I would have had to be in a wheelchair. And the hip replacements, I mean, I had them done. I didn't do them in anticipation of being in Bill Clinton's cabinet because Bill Clinton, you know, was far from having won. And even if he won, I had absolutely no expectation he would pick me. But I had to have them replaced.
One of the hilarious, one of the many hilarious episodes you record in the book Locked in the Cabinet is being prepared for your confirmation hearing. And it wasn't... It wasn't quite what you expected it was going to be, either the preparation or the reality.
No. You know, when you are nominated by a president to be part of his cabinet, you have to go in front of the Senate, the United States Senate, and be confirmed. That's part of our constitutional system. I thought naively that it was going to be a substantive discussion, that they were going to ask me hard questions about policy and I was going to give them my best answers. I was kind of tutored in the weeks leading up to the confirmation hearing that was not really what the confirmation hearing was all about at all. It was more about respect, showing that as a cabinet officer, I would provide kind of due deference and respect to the members of the Senate. And so I was told again and again, don't pick a fight. Don't answer anything other than...
I look forward to working with you, Senator.
Well, say it over and over and over again. Senator, I look forward to working with you. Or if you disagree, say, that's a very interesting and hard question, Senator. I look forward to working with you on that. So it was really a kind of a ritual in which I had to show my deference, my respect, my appreciation for their extraordinary intelligence and authority.
Coming from a parliamentary democracy, we assume that cabinet meetings take place two or three times a week. Cabinet meetings in the kind of administration that you have in the US happen on a very irregular basis. But tell me about the very first cabinet meeting you attended, the one where everybody, where this austerity trading went on. Everybody was scaling down.
Well, you see, by that time, the budget deficit was very, very large. We inherited a huge problem from Reagan and from the first Bush administration, $300 billion, as far as the eye could see, in deficits. So it was impossible for Bill Clinton to do much of what he had told the public he was going to try to do, at least initially, so that the cabinet came together and we all had a kind of an orgy of austerity. You know, I'm going to close my executive dining room. Somebody else said I'm going to do this, and I'm going to end the use of limousines. All symbolic, of course, but it was very important that we show the public that we were serious about cutting the deficit. I said I'm no longer going to fly first class, and it was easy for me. I don't need the legroom, you know. But I had some – Lloyd Bentsen, who was Secretary of the Treasury, a very tall man, looked at me askance and said, well, you may not need first class, but I need first class. And we got into a little bit of a knit about that.
Now, you mentioned you were faced with this huge deficit, and that informed – certainly it comes across in the book – it informed that first period in office for Bill Clinton. Just how powerful is the American president in a situation like that, as against, for example, Congress, or as against, for example, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, which is the U.S. central bank, basically?
Well, the most powerful economic player in the United States, and indeed in any country these days, is the central banker, the number one central banker. Alan Greenspan was head of the Federal Reserve Board. Today it's Ben Bernanke. These people
they have the power to set interest rates.
Well, they set short-term interest rates. That is the money supply. And that's so much more significant now than taxes and spending, fiscal policy, because the short-term interest rates determine how easy it is for people to get a loan, to buy a car, to buy a television set, easy it is for a company to borrow money to make an investment. When short-term interest rates are set high, as they were in the early 1990s because Alan Greenspan was worried about inflation, the entire economy is almost brought to a standstill.
So the central banker is, in essence, more powerful than the president.
Much more powerful than the president. And that was the problem, you see, because Alan Greenspan, the central banker, was telling Bill Clinton, not publicly but privately, if you guys don't bring down the budget deficit in a meaningful way, I, Alan Greenspan, am not going to feel confident that we will not suffer inflation. Therefore, I'm not going to bring down short-term interest rates. And therefore, the economy is never going to get back on its feet.
Meanwhile, Robert Reich is whispering in his left ear, let's not get too bedazzled by the deficit, and let's remember our commitment to invest and invest, invest in education, invest in health, invest in, I suppose, a different kind of wealth creation.
Well, it's just like a family. I mean, if a family goes into debt for the purpose of taking an ocean cruise, that's not very responsible. But if a family goes into debt for the purpose of making sure their children get a good education or go to college or university, or if a family goes into debt to borrow for a new machinery, piece of machinery, so that the family can start a little business, that's not bad debt. That may be actually quite responsible. That's an investment in the future. And Alan Greenspan and the public in general in the 1990s, even today, doesn't make that distinction. The Democrats became the party of fiscal austerity. You know, it was all about cutting the deficit and balancing the budget and even eventually using the surplus to bring down the national debt. Well, I mean, Calvin Coolidge, who was president of the 1920s and was known, he was Republican, known as a fiscal tightwad, would have been
happy. And a very heavy sleeper.
And that's right. Would have been happy with that kind of policy. But that's not a policy in favor of investing in the future.
Let's talk about your 4 years as U.S. Secretary of Labor, some of the things that happened on your watch. Tell me the story of Tommy McCoy, the bat boy, and what you learned from it.
Well, a bat boy is simply the person who a team gives a responsibility to deliver the bats to the batter.
This is the batter comes up.
Yes, this isn't baseball. and usually a little boy or sometimes a girl. But you see, the Department of Labor is charged with enforcing the laws against child labor, and those are very important laws. We can't have little children laboring. They have to be in school on school nights. They can't be working. They have to be at home. But there was a conflict between the child labor laws and this tradition in a little town in Georgia of having on summer and spring evenings when school was still in session a little bat boy anointed by the local team, and it was a professional team. It was this. We're not talking about
it's a minor league baseball.
Yes,
team.
Minor league baseball. And I think my first crisis as Secretary of Labor was when I discovered that one very zealous Department of Labor inspector had insisted that little Tommy McCoy, the bat boy selected for this Savannah, Georgia minor league team, could no longer be the bat boy because it was a school night and it violated the labor laws. And on the face of it, it just seemed absurd. I mean, here his parents were honored by this little boy giving, you know, being given the honor. It was an honor.
He was kind of a mascot
boy, of course, and the school loved it, and the whole town was delighted, and here was big government coming in and saying, no, you can't do this. And word spread. There were protests. There was Atlanta, Georgia, the Major League Baseball stadium. They had a huge protest against it. Well, by the time I heard about it, you know, and when you're at the top of government or in the cabinet of government, you usually hear about things going wrong until the media has got a hold of it and there's going to be a national story, which is exactly what happened. It was going to go on the evening news. And I heard about it, and I had to make a decision about whether to stop this and give Tommy McCoy his job back and run the risk of sending a different kind of signal to the staff of the Labor Department that I was not serious about enforcing the labor laws, that I would basically defer whenever the media gave me a hard time. I would kowtow to the media. Or I was going to tell the public, look, I'm going to be sensible. I'm not going to be an ideological liberal. I'm just going to look at the common sense reality of a situation. And in this particular situation, the common sense thing to do was to give the little boy a chance to be a bat boy. It's not a violation of labor laws. And ultimately, I say ultimately, I only had about an hour to decide. I decided that little Tommy should have the job back, that we were being overly zealous, we were being a little bit stupid. And I, before the evening news went on, I just said that I needed some little quip. I said we were off base in baseball terms, that everybody got the message very, very easily. We should never have done that. You know, you have to regulate. If you're in government, you just have to be sensible. Most people are not ideological. Most people have exercised a lot of common sense. They say, look, there are certain rules and laws that ought to be enforced for certain purposes, but you've got to be reasonable.
You also very successfully used humor on occasions to navigate your way out of potential trouble. Tell me about the screwdriver allegation and its aftermath.
Oh, that was the time the labor unions were a little bit skeptical of me. I had never been...
You were a pointy-headed Harvard professor who
yes,
never worked in his life.
Well, I suppose you could say that, yes. That's the way they viewed it. And it came to a head in one meeting where a particularly skeptical labor union leader said to me, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. You've never even handled a monkey wrench. And I was prepared for him, and I reached under the table and I said, I know what a monkey wrench is. And I brought out a screwdriver and I said, there. And of course, everybody just rolled over in laughter, and everybody knew that I was having a good joke on myself. And that ended that particular problem. I think that being self-deprecating humor is very useful everywhere, but it's particularly useful in Washington because people take themselves so seriously. In my experience, they don't take issues seriously enough, but they take themselves terribly seriously. I wanted to do the opposite. I took issues very seriously, but I was not going to take myself all that seriously.
You had a rude lesson, I think, in realpolitik when you attempted to punish Bridgestone, the tire manufacturer, for worker safety abuses. And people had died in a plant in Oklahoma. People had been very seriously injured in a plant in Oklahoma. What was the background to that and what happened?
they refused, Bridgestone Firestone refused to put a small device on their machines required by law that would prevent the machines from accidentally starting up when workers went in to clean them or unjam the machinery. I was furious when I heard that they were doing this. They did it, I think, because they didn't want to empower unionized workers to slow the line down.
The fixture cost $6.
Oh, the fixture was absolutely – it wasn't a matter of money for the fixture. It was a matter of power. The company did not want workers to have the power to slow the line in terms of union negotiations. But we were talking about lives or limbs or fingers being lost after a particularly gruesome set of incidents where people – actually a number of workers did lose their lives because these machines accidentally did restart because this little – tiny little $6 machine that should have by law been there was not there. I got on my high horse. I went out there. I had a press conference. I brought together workers who had been injured, widows of workers who had been killed. I thought that we would put the pressure of public opinion since the fines, the penalties that we were going to levy against the company obviously had done no good. We'd penalized them several times before. But you see, the company had an ace up its sleeve that I did not realize. This is where my naivete came in, because 2 days later, the company announced that if we, the Labor Department, were going to require them to do what we were saying they had to do, they were going to close the plant entirely. You know, thousands of jobs would be lost. And suddenly, all the people who had been supportive of our action became very scared. They were going to lose their jobs, or their children were going to lose their jobs, or their nieces or nephews. It was a major employer in town. And the stories in the national media were that they all felt this was big government again. It was Washington imposing its values on this small town. We should have just stayed out of their lives. Bridgestone Firestone was at that time owned by a Japanese company. It was not even an American company. So I had to get more subtle, and I got our American ambassador, who at that time was Walter Mondale, ambassador to Japan, to apply pressure. The president made some telephone calls. Finally, Bridgestone Firestone turned around because, you know, no Japanese company wants bad publicity and bad public relations.
In November 1994, 2 years after Bill Clinton was elected, a new brand of conservative Republican, the neocons led by Newt Gingrich, took back the Senate. They took back the House of Representatives. The president had to deal with them for the next 6 years with historic consequences that we all know about. You had to deal with them for 2 years. What was it like?
Oh, terrible. You know, up until they came in, the Newt Gingrich's crowd, there had been civility between Republicans and Democrats in Congress. People liked each other, knew each other, certainly. Hearings were relatively formal, but they were cordial affairs. Once Newt Gingrich's crowd came in 1995, all hell broke loose. I mean, they were vicious, and I mean vicious. I remember one of my first hearings with some of these new Republicans, a fellow named Randy Cunningham, a California Republican who had just been elected and was kind of nasty. He said, "Mr. Secretary, I have read your books and I have read Karl Marx's works and I see nothing of any difference between them." Now, the subject of the hearing had nothing to do with my work or Karl Marx. I mean, I didn't know whether to make a joke about it, but he was quite serious. And he then went on to accuse me of being a communist and what am I doing in government. And postscript, Duke Cunningham is now in federal prison for taking bribes. So there is justice in the world. But that's just one example. The people that Newt Gingrich put into power, the Republicans, and I'm saying this really not because I'm a Democrat. I mean, I would have been appalled if there were vicious Democrats who had been put into power by a Democratic leadership. We should never have been there. They had not the public's interest at heart. They just wanted to make debating points, and they really wanted it. Some of them wanted to wreck the government. That was their objective. The pressures were very intense. I worked 12 to 18 hours every day. I loved the job, would do it again in a heartbeat, but it was the hardest job I ever tried to do.
How much did your family see of you?
Not much, which is the reason I ultimately, after the first term, I said to Bill Clinton, I just have to leave. I have these two young sons becoming teenagers. I need to be with them. He understood. Interestingly, when a man leaves a job and says the reason is to spend more time with his family, people don't believe it. People would say behind their hands, well, why are you really leaving? And I'd say, honestly, I'm leaving because I want to spend more time with my children.
Did it have anything to do with the fact that you were unhappy with the Clinton administration and how it had not delivered on the agenda upon which it had got elected?
Well, undoubtedly, Bill Clinton, after 1995, when the Republicans came into Congress, was put in a very difficult position. He couldn't get as much done. He'd lost the health care battle, wanted to do health insurance, wanted to do much more in education and training, things that I am very committed to. He also brought in pollsters like Dick Morris, and they moved him as fast to the right as possible. That was discouraging. I would have stayed on, though, had it not been for my children. I've had many roles, many jobs in life, but my most important job and the role and job that I am proudest of is my job as father.
You advocate things like profit sharing in businesses, strengthening of unions. These are ideas which seem to fly in the face of current American orthodoxy. Are you optimistic about America's political future and about the possibility of the social change that you've worked for?
Oh, I am very optimistic because every time this country has faced a real social, economic political crisis. And I'm talking now going back to the Civil War, but the Progressive Era, the first decades of industrialization in the 20th century, and then the Depression, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and then the 1960s, getting out of Vietnam, which we did. Every time there has been a tough time, we put ideology aside. We forget whether we're conservatives, Democrats, liberals, whatever, and we get on with what has to be done. There's a streak of practicality here. My recommendations, what I've advocated in terms of tax reform and better education, better opportunities for young people and so forth, I don't think is far out of the mainstream, frankly. I think that we will see it coming. National health insurance. We're the only advanced industrial country that does not have an affordable national health insurance system. That's crazy. It's just absolutely crazy. We pay for it in another way because these people get very sick. They don't have preventive care and they go to the emergency rooms of hospitals. It will happen. I'm very, very optimistic about this country embracing what it needs to embrace. The war in Iraq, I think, has taught a lot of people a lesson I wish they had learned in after Vietnam. But Americans, I hope now understand that we can't unilaterally just go anywhere we want and just with bombs and force think that we are going to change other people's views of who we are and what we are.